Sunny and mild, a high of 43. 33 tonight, 43 again tomorrow. The current numbers wind south at 4. 34 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha at 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's going to be all food today, start to finish. And in part one of today's program, I am really excited to be connecting with Tanaya Darlington, who is known quite affectionately by all kinds of people as Madame Fromage. She is one of our country's leading experts on the marvelous world of cheese. And she has written a marvelous book called Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair It, and Love It from the Creamiest Breeze to the Funkiest Blues. And as we read this book, we come to a better understanding of just how enormous and complex and endlessly fascinating is the world of cheese. And she takes us on quite an odyssey that is really quite entertaining and illuminating. She is by day a professor of English, but she spends nearly all of her waking hours otherwise teaching all kinds of different people about cheese, and tells her own story about her relationship with cheese, if you will, in such captivating fashion. I really love this book, start to finish. It is published by Workman Publishing, again titled Madame Fromage's Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair It, and Love It from the Creamiest Breeze to the Funkiest Blues. And Tanaya Darlington, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much for that fabulous introduction.
Well, I really have enjoyed this. I must confess right off the bat that I am not particularly a fan of cheese, and once upon a time, I could barely even stomach the thought of just popping a piece of cheese into my mouth. To me, so I'm going to tell you about my conversion experience, and then have you share your own story. But I mean, once upon a time, and I suppose it was partly because I wasn't eating good cheese. To me, cheese, just a piece of kind of room temperature cheese, just felt like solid sour milk. Mm. I mean, that's what it felt like to me. And where the first time I really ate cheese and enjoyed it was on a food tour of Greenwich Village, my wife and I, and the last stop on that food tour was Murray's shop, which is one that you mention as one of the major places to purchase cheese in the country. And I think they have something like 400 different kinds of cheese. And so at the end of this brief tour of Murray's, we were each given then a platter of five different cheeses to sample as they talked about each one. And I thought, we paid good money for this food tour. I'm still hungry. I am not going to skip these cheeses, even though I really had to sort of force myself. And I loved it. It was sort of a conversion experience. I never realized just how delicious cheese could be. And I have been a halting explorer of cheese ever since, and that's one reason why I really loved your book. You tell, in some ways, a similar story. Not that you had the aversion to cheese that I did, but you had a really eye-opening, kind of world-altering experience in a similarly marvelous cheese shop. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, in 2009, I moved to Philadelphia, and I didn't know a single person. I was moving there from Wisconsin, a great cheese state, as you know. And so someone had given me the address to a cheese shop called DeBruno Brothers, from an old-world Italian shop with salamis hanging down from the ceiling and huge wheels of cheese on every surface. And I went in there actually looking for a Wisconsin cheese called Pleasant Ridge Reserve. And the guys behind the counter said, "Wow, if you know that cheese, you must really love cheese. And we've got some other things here for you to try, because 10 in the morning on a Tuesday, no one else else is in the shop. And they said, have you ever tried a really great piece of Roquefort cheese? And I hadn't. I'd only ever had Roquefort crumbles. And so one of the guys handed me this kind of gooey, oozy blue cheese, Roquefort from France, caught me by the Carl family. And it was the first time I had tasted real French blue Roquefort right off of the wheel. And it was extraordinary. So strong, but also sweet, salty, and with all these vegetable flavors and mineral notes. And those two guys, Hunter and Zeke, became my cheese mentors. And I ended up going to De Bruyne Brothers weekly for about 5 years, eating every cheese in the shop and blogging about it under the name Madame Fromage. Mm-hmm. So that was my conversion experience.
And it sounds like, you know, as you kind of mentioned that encounter at a couple different points in the book, and one of the things that was so exciting was not just that cheese that you ate but and how delicious it was, but also the stories that that the guy behind the counter was able to tell you about exactly where and exactly how this particular cheese was created. And it sounds like, you know, that was as important as the delicious taste.
That's it. I mean, for that particular cheese, they said, do you know, this is the only Roquefort maker that still bakes homemade rye bread, allows the rye to get moldy. They scrape the blue mold off of the baked rye bread, and they stir that into the milk. That's originally how blue cheese was made. And I had no idea. I've been a blue cheese lover my whole life, but I had no idea that the blue mold in the cheese originated from the same blue mold that just grows on bread when you leave it sitting out. So that to me was fascinating. In fact, last summer I did a Roquefort road trip to visit Carl's Roquefort, to visit those particular makers and meet the family, because it had had such a large impression on me.
Hmm.
So the stories behind cheese are fascinating.
It's incredible. And of course, that is what this book is all about. And I'm so excited to explore it. In what way did you find opportunities to explore this in sort of a wider way? I mean, for instance, when it came to the matter of blogging about cheese or talking about cheese and leading tours, I mean, how were you able to sort of make your way into this world?
That's such a good question. Well, honestly, I thought I would blog for maybe 6 months about cheese because I wanted to, you know, understand the blogging platform, and cheese just seemed like a fun thing to write about at the time. But I can remember that within a few months, I started hearing from cheesemakers. For example, I heard from this guy in northern Scotland named Rory Stone. I had written about his cheese called Strafton Blue. He said, you know, I got this lovely email, dear Tanaya, I Googled myself and I found that you had written about my cheese, and I'm so delighted. I wanted to invite you, if you ever come to Scotland, you know, please come. You'd be a welcome guest at our home, and I'll show you around the farm. And I couldn't believe it. Like, from writing a blog, I was hearing from someone in Scotland with an invitation to learn about, you know, blue cheese making. And I just felt like blogging about cheese began to open all kinds of doors. After I'd been in the writing business for a while, I led two groups to southern Italy to learn about making burrata. That was in Puglia. And from there, I got contacted by a woman in Manhattan who said, I want to start a company called Cheese Journeys, taking people to the great cheese regions of the world. You know, are you interested in joining me? So we've worked together now for 10 years, co-hosting cheese tours, mostly around Europe. And that has taught me so much. So I would say for anybody who really wants to learn about cheese and actually go into cheese caves and meet makers and sit with them in their kitchens, you know, drinking coffee and trying their experiments that are underway, you know, taking a food tour like that is an incredible eye-opener.
Hmm. I want to circle back to your experience at this place called De Bruyne Brothers in Philadelphia, a place that my brother frequented when he lived in Philadelphia and speaks fondly of it. So one of the things you talk about in that is that you say something about how I very soon began carrying a cheese notebook when you would revisit the shop. So I would love to know about what prompted you to do that and what sorts of things you would write in your so-called cheese notebook.
Oh my gosh, I wish I could show you because I have a couple of wine boxes, wooden wine boxes, that are just loaded with all of these little notebooks full of my cheese scribblings from the last decade. Well, before I moved to Philadelphia, I worked as a journalist in Madison, Wisconsin, and I was always carrying a reporter's notebook around. And so even though I transferred, you know, to teaching at a St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, I still was carrying a notebook around. So when the cheesemonger started telling me about cheeses, particularly they'd say, oh, Tanaya, you need to have this cheese, you know, with a chocolate stout, or, oh, Tanaya, this cheese loves cherry jam, I would take notes about, you know, things to pair with the cheese later, or if they told me interesting stories, I would write that down. And so I just began carrying this little cheese notebook everywhere. And then when I would eat the cheese, I would jot down my own observations about the aromas, the taste, what it would be good with. And, you know, I just found that that served me really well as a way to remember the cheeses, but also to go and look up the stories later. So I'm so glad you mentioned that because they're one of the things I've moved around a lot recently. One thing I've never given away are all my little cheese notebooks, and I still carry one around.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Tanaya Darlington, otherwise known as Madame Fromage, and her newest book is called Madame Fromage's Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair It, and Love It, From the Creamiest Breeze to the Funkiest Blues. Before we explore the book, you made passing reference to the fact that you apparently originally were from Wisconsin, or at least you moved from Wisconsin to Philadelphia. If you don't mind my asking, were you in sort of dairy country? It sounds like you were, and that at least the roots of your love of cheese have at least something to do with the time you lived here in the dairy state.
Absolutely. Well, I went to Beloit College. I studied writing. And then I went to graduate school in Indiana to study fiction. But I've moved back to Madison to write for Isthmus newspaper and run the food section and spent a lot of time at the farmer's market and interviewing chefs and artisans, and that really inspired my love of cheese 100%. I will say that my mother's also from Switzerland, so we had a cheese board every Sunday when I was growing up, along with some Swiss chocolate, and that made a huge impression on me as an eater.
Kidding. Well, I just love the way that this book is put together, and early on you call it this, you say this book is a cheese adventure guide. And I think that's just such a nice way to put it. You've laid it out in four grand sections, and I think it makes really lovely sense. Explain just in brief what these four sections of the book are.
Sure. The book takes you essentially through eight styles of cheese, starting with fresh cheeses. These would be like mozzarella or fresh goat cheeses, cheese without a rind. Then we move into our bloomy cheeses. Those are like your Brie, then into stinkers, into cheddars. That's a whole chapter. Alpine cheeses, great mountain cheeses. We get into hard cheeses like your Goudas, your Pecorinos, flavored cheeses, blue cheeses. My goal was to demystify these different styles so that you could eat your way through each style, through each chapter with the pairings that go with that style of cheese. And then hopefully discover like the cheese styles that you really love. Like I love stinkers and blues. Those are like my two favorite chapters in the book. And I think there's so much to be learned from sitting down and tasting a range of cheeses in a particular style. Like one of my favorite things to do is to host a cheddar party and invite people to bring cheddars from different countries, different states, different ages. And you learn so much about the spectrum of cheddar flavors and textures, and also what pairs well with cheddar when you do that. So that's the goal of the book, to train people to become a bit of a cheesemonger in their own house, and also to understand what's behind the different styles of cheese.
Right. And this is as good a time as any to mention the fact that although in reading your book, we're taken on what sort of amounts, in a sense, to a virtual adventure through all these different places, that you have very literally gone to many places all over the world to experience cheese in person. And among the things you mention in the book are the plethora of opportunities to go on these cheese tours. And yeah. It sounds like, I mean, one could spend a whole lot of time, and I suppose a whole lot of money as well. I mean, just exploring the different places around the globe where distinctive cheeses are created and to see it for yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's been one of the great joys in life, is being able to travel with Cheese Journeys, the company I work with, to say Somerset, England, which is the seat of great cheddar. And you go to Somerset and there's these wonderful cheddar makers. Cheddar Gorge is there, which is like the Grand Canyon of England, which is what cheddar is named after. So really getting to understand the history of that cheese, or going to northern Italy to the Piedmont region, where you've got beautiful Taleggio and Robiola and Gorgonzolas and all in the north. I love that. And the way that some people will travel for wine, you know, they'll go to Burgundy or they'll go to Bordeaux. I love going to the cheese regions. And, you know, often there's wonderful things like ciders or beers to try there as well. And you see often that what grows together really does go together. So, and I also always recommend, wherever you're traveling, look up the local cheese shop and start there. Go in and ask about regional cheeses, pick up some cheese to enjoy in your hotel or your Airbnb while you're there. And it's a nice way to get to know a place through the cheese.
I really appreciate the fact that for those of us who are much more beginners in all of this, you do not neglect some of the basics that are really helpful. I mean,
oh, good.
So for instance, there is a really nice section of the book called simply "How Cheese Is Made," in which you you take us into the basic process by which cheese is made. Although within that basic process, of course, are all kinds of variations. But this section of the book begins with three really intriguing words: "Cheese is alive." Explain that. How cheese is alive.
Right. And it's alive in the same way that sourdough bread starts with a sourdough starter, or yogurt starts with a yogurt starter. So it starts with a culture that goes into the milk and feeds on it and essentially transforms something liquid into a solid, and, you know, creates cheese. One thing that's cool about Wisconsin is there's so many cheese curds everywhere, which you just don't get in other parts of the world. And people are often asking me, like, do you really eat cheese curds in Wisconsin? Because you don't see them in other states or even in other countries. But cheese curds are the building blocks for cheese. They get packed into wheels, and then the wheels contain the enzymes from the cultures that break the cheese down. But cheese, even once it arrives in the store, you know, in the form of a wheel, it's still alive. It's still changing. It's ripening. That's one of the things that makes it exciting.
I especially appreciated as well at the beginning of the book a brief history of cheese making. And it occurs to me that this is probably not the easiest history to trace. I mean, in part because you have a history that is unfolding in different parts of the world and in different ways and so on. And I was also astonished that this historical timeline is as long as it is. I mean, what would be a couple of interesting points about the history of cheese? And I guess wrapped up in that is also the question of why did you feel it would be useful to the listener to have at least a passing acquaintance with this long historical timeline?
Well, once I started traveling in Europe, I just realized what an incredible history there was for cheese here and in many other parts of the world too. But for example, I went to the town, the village of Gouda, which, you know, is a city in Holland where there just used to be a massive Gouda trade along the canals. And I thought, wow, people probably don't know that, like, the first mention of the word Gouda appears in the 1100s. Like, we think of it as just the sooner cheese you see on the grocery shelf, but it goes so far back. Or, you know, that the taste buds were invented in the late 1800s. We take taste buds for granted, but one of the things we enjoy about cheese are all the flavors that unfold on our tongues. And so just even dropping that into the timeline, I thought was a fun detail. And then I also wanted to mention, like, in 2006, the very first all-American artisan cheese shop opened in New York, which, you know, is significant because America has a pretty young cheese culture, and most cheese counters carry a lot of European cheeses. There was a woman named Anne Saxelby who really championed American artisan cheese, and she opened the very first all-American cheese stand in Essex Market in New York City. So I wanted to put those sorts of things on the timeline to give people just a sense of the spectrum and all of the cool details that exist in the history of cheese.
Right. I appreciate that your book, although in so much of it is devoted to what, you know, in some ways we might think of as wondrous exotic cheeses from all over the world, there is this wonderful moment early in the book when you talk about the way in which a whole lot of people encounter cheese, and a whole lot of people probably never encounter cheese in any other way but in those cheese singles, I mean, in the little plastic sleeves. And and I so appreciate what you have to say about this, including the fact you say, I'm not going to lie, there is something seductive about watching a processed cheese slice melt over a burger. But you go on to tell us a sobering fact, singles do not contain actual cheese. So explain what, in fact, they do contain, and if we should be thinking about these as cheese at all.
Good question. Well, I think a lot of industrial cheeses actually contain milk powders and oils and other things that allow something like a soft cheese to have a long shelf life. So while the single might be something you know, fun from childhood, and I say there's always a reason for any kind of cheese, even like a spray can of cheese while you're camping, right? But it's not necessarily the truest definition of cheese. So at some point you have to move on.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Tanaya Darlington, also known as Madame Fromage, and we're talking about her terrific new book called Madame Fromage's Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair It, and Love It from the Creamiest Breeze to the Funkiest Blues. One of the things we have not yet mentioned is that in addition to the various adventures on which you take us, you also introduce us to some individual people who are involved in the world of cheese and in various ways. And I so appreciate that that these very personal encounters are part of this book. I think I want to have you explain a particular woman whose role in this is something that I had never even heard of until I read your book. So let's see, in the French, is it affineur? A-F-F-I-N-E-U-R?
Yep, affineur practices affinage, which rhymes with massage, and that's essentially the person who massages cheeses or cares for wheels of cheese once they have left the cheesemaker or the cheesemaking room. Yeah, it's its own little industry. The people who run cheese caves and age cheese or mature cheeses. And there's two affineurs in the book. One is a woman named Betty Koster who ages, she's famous for aging Goudas. And another is a woman named Olivia Haver who gives her great story about washed rind cheeses at Jasper Hill in Vermont. So I'm so glad you mentioned that because I wanted each of the chapters to introduce you to somebody in the industry, from cheesemongers to cheesemakers to affineurs, because I think when you pick up a cheese at the grocery, you don't think about all of the roles that go into making cheese, but it starts with, you know, someone milking the cows, and it ends with somebody, you know, affectionately caring for the cheese and packaging it and putting it on a truck and shipping it to you.
Right. And by the way, in your book, you mentioned the fact that it makes all the difference in the world when the cows giving us the milk have been pasture raised, and mm-hmm. that the quality of what those cows are eating has a whole lot to do with the quality of the cheese that will ultimately be created. And that's one reason why some cheeses can be rather expensive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm so glad you picked up on that. Yeah, you're in Wisconsin, which is a great state for pasture-raised animals and if you think about it, cows that are eating grass are essentially just, you know, eating chlorophyll, and that's what goes into the milk. So I would say a cheese is a plant-based food, and it's as close to a plant-based food as you can get. So when I go to the store, whether it's a grocery store or a cheese shop, I'm often looking for, you know, grass-based or pasture-raised, because I think it makes the best cheese.
You also mentioned at one point in the book that milk, when it comes to making cheese, doesn't necessarily come from cows. There's goat milk, there's sheep mm-hmm. milk, there's water buffalo milk. And yeah. And I suppose that if one is starting with a different kind of milk, you're going to end up with a very different kind of cheese.
Absolutely. Each of the milks have different levels of protein, different nutrients, different levels of butterfat, resulting in different textures and flavors. It's really fascinating. So I'm so glad you mentioned water buffalo, because it's one of the richest milks. I've never seen a water buffalo being milked, but I'm told the milk comes out looking almost like coconut milk. It's so thick and so rich.
Wow.
So it's one of my goals in life.
I want to give you just a minute or two to pick one of the eight specific cheese adventures on which you take the reader in your book, Adventures mm-hmm. in Cheese, one that you think might be especially enticing or interesting.
Oh, sure. I love the stinky cheese tour, because it's an adventure that goes from mild to wild. So I suggest you start with something like a Taleggio, which is kind of, I think, mildly whiffy, and then get a few other cheeses leading up to a Poisse, which is one of the stinkiest cheeses you can possibly get. Comes in a balsa wood box. It's bright orange. It's from Burgundy, France. And to me, that cheese tastes almost like beef stew. You get these like braised meat notes, onions, garlic. It's one of my favorite cheeses to have in the winter, especially if you just, you know, you want to take a break from having a roast or have a meatless meal night. And a Poisse with some warm potatoes, some, you know, crusty bread, a good bottle of white Burgundy or like a Belgian style beer is just a wonderful, wonderful dinner. You do want to open the windows and maybe have some incense handy.
Very good. In the third chapter called Entertain, you really share a whole lot of really interesting information, including how to taste cheese like a pro. And one of the things you mention either there or elsewhere in this section of the book is how many people who really know something about tasting cheese properly will do something called scrape the face. Explain what it means to scrape the face when one is about to taste a potentially delectable piece of cheese.
That's such a, you picked up on great things in the book. Yeah, you know, when cheese is wrapped in plastic, a little bit of that plastic kind of will adhere to the cheese and affect the taste. And so at a really good cheese shop, they'll take off the plastic wrap, and the cheesemonger will just take a knife and scrape the cheese that was exposed to the plastic, so that what you're tasting is a really fresh bit of that cheese. That's one of the marks of a great cheese shop, is that they scrape the face. And you can do that at home as well. If you have a cheese that's been shrink-wrapped and you don't know how long it's been in the wrapping for a while, the first bite closest to the plastic, if you'll notice, it tastes a little bit like the plastic. So you can just cut that off or scrape the face of the cheese, and it'll be a much more pleasurable bite for your guests.
And there's a section of this part of the book that is on how to care for your cheeses at home, which gives all kinds of very, very helpful information on where to store your cheese and so on. I want to make sure to give you a chance to talk briefly about a section of the book which is called A Template for a Great Cheese Board. And of course, there are a whole lot of people who just do this all the time and have, you know, probably done it for years, and others who are just sort of waking up to the wonderful possibilities of setting before company a beautiful, wonderful cheese board. Your template is so intriguing, because you suggest, I mean, this is one way to do it anyway, to you can put together a great cheese board with three different cheeses that are, in a sense, each from a different category. And I just love this idea.
Oh, good.
Yeah, tell our listeners about this.
Sure. Well, most cheese people will recommend, you know, if for a cheese board, choose, you know, cheeses of different milks. And for years I did that. But I feel like after a while you want to, you know, find a different formula for a cheese board. So one that I came up with that I love is you pick a comfort cheese. So that's a cheese you know and love. It might be a Gouda or a cheddar. But maybe each time you put out this cheese, you pick a different brand or a different age. So you start with a comfort cheese. Then you have a conversation piece. And that's a cheese that stands out to you at the cheese counter. Maybe it's rolled in an interesting herb. Maybe it's wrapped in bark, like Rush Creek from Wisconsin right now, which I think is such a beautiful conversation cheese. Or it's a cheese wrapped in leaves. But there's something intriguing going on. Maybe it's marinated in booze. And then your third cheese should be from close by. So something local or regional to showcase your state or your farmer's market. So I think that's a nice way to grow your cheese knowledge, keep your cheese lovers who you're inviting over interested, support the cheese economy even locally, a comfort cheese, a conversation piece, and then something close or local. Thanks so much for pointing that one out.
Right. And there's many more ideas that you share in the book on how you can put these cheese boards together to not only offer up deliciousness, but also to be visually exciting and appealing. Just to finish out, I want to ask you about something that I have been curious about for such a long time. And that is the fact that, as I said at the outset, it took a long time before I would really just pop room temperature or cold cheese into my mouth. But always I have loved, you know, macaroni and cheese and cheese fondue and nachos, and to me, melted cheese was a completely different experience than just a piece of cheese. Yeah. And I just wonder, does something happen to cheese when it is heated, when it is melted?
Definitely, and some cheeses melt better than other cheeses, as you've probably noticed. Like a sheep's milk cheese just gets really oily, for example, like Manchego is not a good melter, but something like the Alpine cheeses tend to be really great melters. Usually if they have some elasticity, a cheese will be a great melter. So like raclette, a wonderful cheese made in Switzerland and France, is just, it's a genius melter of a cheese. Even like a Monterey Jack, you see that it's very flexible when you cut a slice. Any of those very flexible cheeses tend to be wonderful, wonderful melters.
Well, I am glad to say that I have entered this world of cheese in a big way. At least I've stepped away from macaroni and cheese and to enjoy a much wider array of cheeses. And your book excites me and inspires me to want to further that journey. And I know our listeners are probably enticed as well to make some exploration of their own. And you can be their guide with this lovely new book called Madame Fromage's Adventures in Cheese, How to Explore It, Pair It, and Love It from the Creamiest Breeze to the Funkiest Blues. And we've really just skimmed the surface in terms of all that is to be found in this book published by Workman Publishing. The author, Tanaya Darlington, Madame Fromage herself. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for giving the world this really terrific book.
Thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I have really been enjoying the opportunity to explore an absolutely beautiful cookbook called A Man and His Kitchen, Classic Home Cooking and Entertaining with Style at the William Brown Farm. And the author is Matt Horanek. And he is a well-known lifestyle writer and photographer. WM Brown is the magazine, men's lifestyle magazine, that he founded and edits. He is the author of A Man and His Watch, The Martini, and several other books, and has now given the world this really lovely book in which he, first of all, in the opening section, transports us to the amazing place where he and his family live at least most of the year, and then shares some of the wonderful recipes that spring out of the kitchen of their beautiful home. And it's an absolutely lovely book, and I have enjoyed it so very, very much. It's published by Artisan, and I'm excited to speak with Matt Horanek about A Man and His Kitchen. Matt Horanek, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it.
In the introduction to the book, you tell a really wonderful story about one of your favorite exploits when you were a youngster. Tell us what you would often be doing in terms of your own imagination and the world of cooking shows.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, and I had a very rich fantasy life, and television was a great transporter for me and a great educator, at least at that period. And I was in love with cooking shows so much, cooking shows like Jacques Pepin and The Galloping Gourmet, that I used to pretend I had a cooking show in my kitchen. And we had a window, like a picture window out to the backyard in the kitchen. And I would pretend that was my television audience while I was quite vocally explaining how to make bologna sandwiches to my mother's complete curiosity and dismay. She would say, I remember her would yell up from the basement and say, like, you know, Matthew, who are you talking to? And I would say, oh, my television audience. And she just would be like, okay, like, that was totally normal. But that is really who I was talking to. I was obsessed with food. I grew up in Binghamton with an aunt that had a very classic American diner with an Italian twist, and an uncle had a bar with the same variety. And I just kind of grew up with these amazing nurturers, people that showed love through food, and they did a good job of it.
That they did. So I tell our listeners who don't have your book in front of them and can't see some of these gorgeous photographs, tell them about this really special place where you and your family live in upstate New York most of the year.
Sure. That farm, that piece of land that my wife and I bought 20-some years ago was really an escape from New York in the urban environment that, you know, we were kind of in these cramped spaces, kind of forging our way in New York. And we both were looking for the escape, and William Brown Farm became that escape, 2.5 hours from New York, very isolated in the middle of a forest and field. And we wanted to kind of build our escape and life there when we weren't in the city. And that just evolved into this wonderful lifestyle experiment that became the William Brown Project, which is a blog I wrote. And it was part of an old dairy farm called William Brown Farm. And the plots were kind of broken up for vacationers and hunting camps and stuff like that in upstate New York in the 50s and 60s. And we bought this big piece of land, lived in an Airstream for a few summers, and then built this house that is there now that, you know, my whole idea about that house was like to build a living space around a kitchen, because we knew that's where everybody wants to end up. That's where everybody wants to entertain. And I didn't want to be isolated and lonely in the kitchen. So that's how that house was built. And that's how we use it. We use it for entertaining. We use it for kind of decompression. And the only activity up there anyone's required to do is think about what the next meal is.
You tell us that this book is a collection of the meals that have sprung up from many, many conversations. Explain the nature of those conversations that have, in a sense, given rise to this beautiful book we're talking about today.
Well, like I said, there's not much distraction up at that house but nature and, you know, nurture, really. And, you know, growing up, food was a big dialogue that was constantly around this big Italian family I was, you know, being raised by on my mother's side. And I think that translated into how we looked about what the next event was that day at the house. So at breakfast, we talked about lunch, and at lunch, we talked about cocktails and dinner. And then at dinner, we talked about what we were going to have for breakfast. And that, you know, cooking was always a kind of decompression and kind of a bit of therapy for me. It was conversations that we enjoyed. We all liked planning together. And they also talked about these ideas of food souvenirs. I was traveling a lot as a photographer and bringing back ideas and ingredients to share with people, my family and friends, that weren't on that journey or trip with me. So they were subjects that we really enjoyed talking about that certainly weren't as heavy as politics.
So ultimately, this book is a collection not only of some of your very, very favorite recipes, but also a book in which you share some of your thoughts on your principles or your values as a homeowner and as a home chef. And I really appreciated one page in your book very early on with the headline, "Everything Must Go," in which you begin with these intriguing words: "I hate waste of all kinds, but I hate kitchen waste the most." Just give our listeners at least a rough sense of the length to which you go to see that nothing is needlessly wasted in the kitchen.
I go through such lengths that if I'm working on a recipe and, you know, I've thrown something in the compost bin, like parsley stems or old celery, and I'm like, oh, wow, that would be so good for this recipe, I will go back into the compost bin and, like, rinse it off, rinse off the coffee grounds and add it to the recipe. You know, I grew up with, you know, first-generation immigrant, you know, my grandparents were immigrants from Italy and from Eastern Europe, and, you know, they were in America during the Depression, and I just kind of paid witness to how the economy of kitchen and how they use and reuse things, and you know, also being very isolated in this place in upstate New York, sometimes you forget something or you don't have it around and you have to kind of repurpose things, and sometimes that's an end of an onion that you've just tossed into the compost bucket. But And also we have these recipes called, like, must-goes, like at the end of the weekend or the week when all these bits of leftovers are in the kitchen, like, how do you repurpose those things from the refrigerator to make a kind of elegant meal that you kind of celebrate as a new dish, you know? And that that comes from that philosophy of not wanting to throw things away and not want to waste things. I think this stuff is too precious just to dispose of most of the time.
Mm-hmm. So I appreciate also some thoughts that you share on what you think essential kitchen equipment is, and the way people should sort of think about that, particularly people with limited means. I mean, what their priorities should be in terms of with what sort of implements they should be armed, so to speak, in order to really cook effectively and joyously in the kitchen?
Well, I think kitchen equipment is something that, you know, we're bombarded and have been for generations of, like, all these gadgets that you need to buy to make it easier, you know, to make life easier. I think when it comes right down to it, you need a great knife. You need a really good quality knife that stays sharp and, you know, will last. I do think that's the worthwhile investment. I do think good pans, cast iron, stainless steel, what have you, are always really good investments to make. Sure, would it be great if you had a food processor and a standing mixer? Great. But, you know, the crock pot, which, you know, the slow cooker, is still one of the most inexpensive kitchen gadgets that I just love, that takes a lot of pressure off the kitchen and is just a joy to use. And I don't put a lot of emphasis on spending lots of money on gadgets, but there are some essentials, like I said: knife, pans, good spatula, you know, a good peeler, you know, stuff like that is worth spending money on. All the rest is a little bit frivolous at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Explain to our listeners how this beautiful book, from that point on, once you're over kind of some of the introductory remarks about what we have just been talking about, plus your thoughts on buying organic and so on. Once we are into the heart and soul of the book, these beautiful recipes, explain how you have laid this book out. I think it's a really intriguing and effective choice.
We laid it out how we sort of eat through the day. You know, we have mornings, afternoons, evenings, cocktail hour is sort of tucked in there, and sort of after dinner. And there's definitely a specific way we eat lunches up there, more kind of quick fire and maybe involve the grill more and not as involved with lots of tiers of, you know, appetizers and things like that. And that was a very conscious effort to kind of think about how you go about your day and how you approach your menu prep. I mean, we really have to think about and talk about what we're going to have for lunch in the morning, because we may need to drive, I don't know, X amount of miles to get to the market to figure that out, because things aren't conveniently close, or we may want to go to the farmer's market and buy something special. And I think that to think like that in terms of your day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, mornings, afternoons, and evenings, is a good way to think about planning meals and food and being prepared for what's next.
I like that. I appreciated, among other things, being a burger lover, a page where, ahead of some specific burger recipes, you just offer some general thoughts about burgers and what you think makes an especially great burger. Would you mind just highlighting a couple of excerpts from that?
Sure. I mean, burgers are really, they're really like pizza, or, I mean, they're a polarizing thing. Like most people who eat hamburgers have this amazing, very strong opinion about how they like their burger, you know, smash burger on the grill in the pan, you know. My philosophy about the burger is, I love them in the barbecue first and foremost. I like them a little bit thicker than a smash patty. I often eat them without a bun and kind of treat it like the French do, with the kind of idea of a steak cachet, or, you know, I love an open face burger. I just think that, because basically the burger becomes a carrier for, you know, lettuce, onion, special sauce, and all that stuff. But I make my burgers with 80%, it's like 80-20, 80%, you know, beef. I try to use organic or grass-fed beef, to 20% fat. And a little bit on the, you know, on the thicker side of things. And, you know, and like I said, this book is designed to put your own impression and make things the way you want it. It's just this is like a launch pad for how you want to create your own dialogue in the kitchen and with your food. And I'm not very strict about that, but that's how I do it, and that's how I like it.
Right, and I like the way that's laid out. I'm excited to try to make your lamb burgers. That looks so wonderful. And on that same page, you have a recipe for mashed sweet potatoes and carrots that looks really, really good. Do you have time for one more question?
Absolutely.
It's really interesting how a lot of what is in this book we would think of as maybe more contemporary recipes or a contemporary take on classics. But one of the recipes right here is Mom's Meatballs. And I know that early in the book you lament the fact that you don't have all of the recipes of things that you remember and have cherished memories of eating and enjoying during your childhood. But you do have your mom's meatball recipe, and it looks like it's something special.
My mom's meatballs are a hit. And, you know, if I look through the course of my life of growing up in that kitchen, the meatballs have always been, you know, just something we always look forward to. And when we go visit my mom now with my daughter, my wife, there will always, over the course of the visit, there will always be those meatballs. And recently, when I had a book event out in Beverly Hills at this fantastic place called Dante, they wanted to do some recipes out of the book to serve. And the chef came up to me and said, we did your mom's meatballs. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's the stress of that. Okay, can I taste one? And he said, well, you know, they're cold. And I said, that's fine. That's the way we first would steal them out of the kitchen fridge. Like, my mom would fry them, or, you know, the day before, or the early in the day, and then put them in the fridge. And that, to me, was like the best barometer. And he brought out a cold meatball. And I ate it, and it just immediately transported me. And I said, oh, my gosh, like, that's my mom's meatball. And that, to me, made me so happy, because the recipe really does work. It evokes all the emotion of me eating those meatballs growing up. And it's a very kind of Italian-American standard, and a lot of people have their very, very strong opinions about that. But for me, my mom's meatballs are the best, and that is a very good recipe in there.
Right. Well, I'm very much taken by all kinds of things in this wonderful book. And it's just beautiful to look at. But also, I think, will be very exciting for home chefs to explore. The book, again, is A Man and His Kitchen, Classic Home Cooking and Entertaining with Style at the William Brown Farm, published by Artisan and the author, Matt Horanek. Matt Horanek, thank you so much for this beautiful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes and happy cooking.